You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, and we have with us Josie Turner, who's got some new projects in line that I've learned about, and she's also going to treat us to some of her poetry. So why don't you start out and read us a poem?
I'd like to. So my most recent collection is Poetry of the Moment. I sort of believe that poets, they're a creature of where they live, the time that they live in. And being that we have all been hit with this pandemic and this quarantine, I have been using the time to write some poetry about it. The first one came from an inspiration as I was walking my dog, Charlie, around my neighborhood, which is Proctor. And those of you that live in Tacoma would know that. It's the first in the series. It's called Proctor Prayer, Spring 2020. And there are some references in here that locals will probably recognize. Alfredo is standing outside cooking pizza in his wood fire stove on wheels. His restaurant shuttered. I walk my sausage-sniffing dog past Chef. He calls out a hearty, "Hello, darling, how are you?" Smiles are infectious. Safeway's parking lot is half full. People circle the Met. I buy a dozen roses, ash and damask, like my mother's old linen. Not exactly edible, but food for my soul, and continue walking. Mason School's soccer field is empty. Even the dogs are inside. Terry's Tavern is shuttered, but Garden Sphere is wide open and outside business. It's too early for geraniums and too cold for basil, but sweet peas are starting. There is new life coming. A friend just welcomed a new granddaughter. Pink and blue hyacinths pepper my garden. Deer are birthing fawns. Mother Mary, may we all live to summer.
So we're dealing with the pandemic poetry, which gives us a scene of Proctor. That sausage sniffing dog, is it a sausage dog that was sniffing, or is it a dog sniffing sausage?
It's a dog sniffing sausage. Okay. It's Peyton.
Very good. You mentioned that you're actually doing some kind of libretto for Greg Utes, quite a famous Tacoma composer.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call it a libretto. I sent a few of these poems out to just a collection of friends of mine, thinking this will give them all something to think about. And Greg is actually working on an opera right now for Tacoma Opera. And he said, you know, when I finish this, maybe I'd like to play with these if it would be all right and do a song cycle. And I said, sure, why not? So we'll see where it goes.
Well, you are lucky. I'm sure,
yes.
I'm sure it picks up your spirits to work on some poems, you know, might have fine musical accompaniment. Huh?
It really does. It really does. It's funny because Greg asked me, he said, have you ever put any of your poems to music? And it sort of took me back to my teenage years in '70s of playing my guitar and writing songs. And that's sort of how I started writing poetry, but I didn't know I was writing poetry at the time. And I was telling Greg that they were embarrassingly bad.
Oh, embarrassing. You don't have any of those embarrassing ones in front of you today, do you?
No, I don't.
Well, when you were poet laureate, I know you had a few programs that you set up. You didn't necessarily probably have to, did you, for those years?
No, there are lots of requirements when you're a poet laureate. And part of the honor is to give back to the community. I gave lots of workshops. I organized a reading in conjunction with the gallery at TCC. And
oh, yes. And fine little place, yeah.
Yes. And she was having an exhibit on mythology. And so I organized a group of women poets. We all wrote original pieces around mythology, and we did a reading there, and then we produced a chapbook. So that was one of the things I did. But my tenure ended in 2013. So it's been a while ago.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I remember meeting Billy Collins at the library after he was poet laureate, and I asked him, I said, what sort of appointments did you have being W. Bush's poet laureate? And he said, well, he says, you know, I didn't care much about what was going on in the government. I just went to my office there and I looked out the window with my hands in my pockets, and then I saw something on my desk and I just started to write about what was sitting on my desk. So poetry can come from just about anything. It doesn't have to be so august, but we are in strange times that might bring about some memorable poetry of an unusual time.
Yeah, I think so. I have been teaching at Clover Park High School since 2009, and primarily for the last many, many, many years, I teach seniors. And it's hard not to think about seniors and what they're going through right now, and certainly their memories, which yesterday, this is a fresh poem. It's for them. And because I've been teaching seniors, and as a teacher, the life of senior year is cyclical, and there's always predictions of what happens, and you get used to the rhythm and the ebbs and flows of all of this. But when you're a senior, everything's for the first time and it's monumentous. And so it's really big. And one of the assignments I do is I have them write a graduation speech. And fortunately, we had just finished our graduation speeches and they had just finished presenting them right before we got shut down, I should say. And so I chose the form of a villanelle. You probably know it. It's secular. And thinking about this way of senior year, and I have it titled Class of 2020 for Samantha. When you are 17, everything matters. That boy or girl who smiled at you, graduation, prom, those moments of breathless wonderment, which surely a parent or a teacher could never understand. Could they even remember being young? For when you are 17, everything matters. Senior night, awards ceremonies, that last paper to write, ever, at least in high school. For prom comes soon, promising breathless memories. Or that is the way it should be, and you thought you were promised after 13 long school years, because when you are 17, everything matters. But this year, something called COVID stands in your way, not your fault, and I agree, unfair. No prom, just keep breathing, keep wondering why, and that's okay. My mother used to say, this too shall pass. That's a lot to trust, you say. For when you are 17, everything matters. You long for prom, for breathless moments in wonderment.
Oh, some choice repetitions in that villanelle. Yes, that's the way the villanelle works to its best. And so you had to choose those phrases that you wanted to have repeated. Yes, very good. Yeah. So you are teaching by distance now?
We will, yes. I've been giving them packets. And this week we venture into the new format, Microsoft Teams. And we'll see how all that works out. The district's working very hard to make sure that all the students have access to some sort of technology and the internet, because a lot of students don't have that access, and there are equity issues. And the AP exams, they did move those by a week, but that's still not very much time. And the AP did say that the test this year is only going to be 45 minutes rather than 3 hours. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just a problematic time for students and for teachers. Yes.
Is it a learning curve for you too then?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Have you had engagements with your students then through, the Microsoft program?
Not yet, Teams. Teams is the program.
Teams, Microsoft Teams, yeah.
Right, but several of them have been sending me emails, and former students have been sending me emails, which is quite delightful. It's really sweet. They're all grown up and they've graduated from college or they're doing whatever, and they're all like, Turner, what are you doing?
Right. Well, that's right.
You know?
But then this is a time for poets to be, to enjoy working in their leisure.
Yes.
I saw in Atlantic magazine several things that people should do during the pandemic tranquility. And one of them was write a poem a day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to everybody, you know, suggesting
right.
it as a an exercise for just about anybody, because thoughts are a little different. Don't you find
they
that
are.
Poetry is to express thoughts differently?
Yeah, and I think it's a very contemplative time. I like to garden. One of my poems comes out of that and made me think about how it's a solitary time and it's a quiet time. And it's kind of an eerily quiet time. You know, because you usually hear rustlings around the neighborhood. I don't know what your neighborhood's like, but there aren't the normal rustlings. And so this one I've called March is the Hardest Time of Year. And the title is actually the first line of the poem.
Right. Go ahead.
March is the hardest time of year, not quite real spring as winter's north air cause naked branches to shiver. Tree trunks expose all their imperfections. Nightshade engulfs, threatens young tulips, while dahlias still slumber in dark soil beds. The gardener paces, inspecting hardy fuchsias for any sign of baby green hope, while guilty squirrels scamper, bulb in cheek, deep into an evergreen hedge. Gravel paths crunch under her feet, claw trowel in hand, she pokes around rose roots, sprinkling fertilizer, clipping away last season's dead wood, listening for children or cars on her strangely quiet street. Like nesting birds protecting their young, all her neighbors are behind their blinds, closing out the air, the season, waiting for the virus, its poison contagion, to blow away and life to begin again.
An excellent idea to choose the point of view of animals. What does an animal feel during this time? Like, you can imagine the bird saying, why is my whistle so much more piercing?
Right?
And that squirrel, not so much to be afraid of right now. Why?
Nope.
Nervous little things.
Yesterday, one of the wildlife parks, I believe it was in Africa, but all the big cats, because nobody was around, all went and lied down in the middle of the road.
Ah, yes.
And apparently the coyotes are roaming free in San Francisco.
I've heard that. I was in Idaho and noticed how the wildlife was just everywhere on the roads. Deer, coyotes also didn't seem to be as afraid. They would stand in the field and look at you and just not run away.
Yeah. Because, well, what are they to do, right?
We're sparser.
Right. We are. And I think about, many people my age, my parents went through World War II. And my mother used to talk about different kinds of illnesses that went through during her childhood. And she used to speak a lot about my Aunt Jane, who spent a year in bed. And so this one I've titled Aunt Jane. My mother used to speak of Aunt Jane's illness, a year in bed, a year of seemingly San Francisco fog, a year of smallpox, a year of hushed silence, a year without friends for any of the sisters, I think it was 1926 or 27. One burned in her memory till she died at 91, clutching her rosary. Mama, today you would have bunkered canned soups, tomatoes, soaps. You were not a baker and would have laughed at my purchase of the wrong flour to try to bake bread. Josephine, I shiver hearing that sound. But we would have teepee, Clorox, powdered milk, and butter in the freezer. Dog food, oh, plentiful. The dog would be exempt from any wrongdoing, undirected barking, sniffing inappropriately, misguided peeing. The human, me, would be at fault. Josephine, she would write letters, post them, expect the postman to return replies, and that I miss, a handwritten note, a personal reply. But we have email, we have Facebook, we have fake news. Could I just have a plump newspaper on my porch twice a day, one everyone reads, one everyone discusses? But then I look at the grandchildren who are not mine, yet are mine, and they will live through this, only remembering the time their Aunt Jane spent a month in the ICU, and they pasted window drawings to cheer her, encourage her. Aunt Jane.
Oh, good memory. Is Aunt Jane passed away?
Oh, yes. Many years ago.
Huh?
Yeah. She would be well over 100. Yeah. Because my mother would
and
be...
That's okay. I was going to ask when you actually wrote that poem. What was the time?
Oh, these were all fresh. These were all inspired
so
by
new
pandemic. Poems. Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Yes, wartime. There's lots of metaphors that have been coming up regarding this particular time.
Yes.
I'm sure there'll be a great number of them for poets to work with too.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been noodling around one that's not quite finished having to do with ration books.
Yes.
Because that was another constant theme my mother would tell me about were ration books.
Well, that could be also a science fiction topic, because
yes.
Who knows, 5-6 years from now.
Possibly, you never know. I mean, who would have ever thought you would go into a grocery store and find such bare shelves, right?
Right.
Yeah, so what other ideas does this particular time arouse in you? Any others that are off those marks?
Well, this is one, it's pretty dark, but the Depression. And this is, I think, the most politically charged one of the group. It's called Devil's Bargain. Dorothea Lange, your photograph of a woman's soul grappling for survival awakens my midnights after keeping the news on too long. Pundits predicted depression worse than nearly 100 years ago, and there's argument over to work or to die or dying to work, a devil's choice. To mate light, is it the chicken or her egg? If there are no people, there is no work. No eggs, no meat, no harvest. History, dear child, repeats itself in black and white. Stocks were always sold at night. Tips were always traded, while suits looked away with unabashed, unashamed hubris and pride, condemning parents whose children starved.
Yes, that is dark, but poets enjoy darkness. In dark times, they're very, very appropriate poems too.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's one that does inspire sort of that grumpy soul of a poet, you know.
Well, that phrase, dying to work,
uh-huh.
You know, work does kill in many occupations in the world, but and we think that we have to work to live, but so the
yes.
concept of work might very well undergo some change in definitions and connotations as we go on.
I think that many things are going to change. Many things are going to change.
Do you think this comeuppance is good for us?
Perhaps. I'm more of a reflective person, and I think being in the middle of it, it's really hard to tell, but I think it is making all of us think differently about how we spend our time. I was rather pleased to hear the ozone is repairing itself because we're not driving so much.
Yes.
And so I think that there are some things that could be good coming out of it. We're going to be, I think, much more aware, and I hope we become kinder people. As a society, I think we've lost that looking out for one another in a big general sense. So I hope we become kinder.
Yes, maybe some kindness that's learned by being close together in the household might become a habit out on the street.
One can hope. Yeah.
Conversation may be reclaimed in some ways through this.
Well, I think by virtue of the platforms like Teams and Zoom and these other ones, people crave that face-to-face contact.
Yes.
And, you know, I've been FaceTiming my nieces and talking to them, and it's just nice to see them and to connect with them.
Do you feel that you're doing two things at the same time, though, when you're FaceTiming and talking to and seeing things in a different way? I mean, we are seeing things quite differently in these little pictures.
Right.
That you often spend a little bit of time observing around the person. What's in that room there as you're chatting, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because it's a different space and it's not your own space that you're inviting someone else into.
In the different media, I mean, it's as though there are two or three media at work sometimes. We have our voices, but we see one another. And there may be ambient sounds too, although we try to cut those out, I think, when we're on FaceTimes and Zooms. But what I've noticed is that if a person is reading, say a person is reading something rather intellectual, I don't think it comes across as very profound or memorable or as intelligible when a person's reading something rather than when their face is looking at you and just talking, speaking.
Right. No, I mean, it is different. Mm-hmm. It is different. And I think, you know, there's something that is really precious about that in-person reading. And as a poet, when I'm reading and giving a public reading, I'm always in tune with the little noises in the audience of, you know, you can hear a breath catch or a little sigh. And those are always sort of these underlining clues of something. Either it's And I find it feeds my own reading of my work. Then
hopefully the sounds aren't too many dry coughs or loud sneezes.
Oh, I don't mind those.
So long as you're on Zoom.
Right. You know, I
By the way, read another. We'd like you to read another one. You've got several, have you?
So sometimes I write poems to tease my students a little bit. I'm of the generation that grew up diagramming sentences and looking at different parts of speech. And that's not taught anymore. And so I was having fun with my students and having them look at the format of a poem and trying to learn different things about both grammar and the way poems are put together. So so this is one that I wrote. It's called I Was Dreaming Poetry. I was dreaming poetry, dreaming of teaching Tennyson when this noun nudged and noodled its way into my brain, almost awakening me. but a verb puffed, pushed, and pulled my pillow around my head, standing guard against a growing army of nouns. Now joining the ranks, adverbs quickly and precisely lined themselves up like little toy soldiers. The verb held her ground, sending them to another cloud. A college ruled with a thick forest of Ticonderogas, where sweet, beautiful, yet obnoxious adjectives were shouting, shoving, even cajoling articles, especially the, to fall into the middle of another line. The verb became a chaperone, overlooking a budding romance between stanza and couplet, who were stealing pairs of kisses while winking and coaxing nouns to awaken me for morning to perform their marriage blessing.
Wild syntax, eh? wild turns of phrases.
Sometimes, you know, it's fun to get out of the seriousness of poetry and to write a little joke.
Right. Well, you could have written that as the sharp-tongued aunt you wrote about earlier, but you made it into your own state of sharpness and pointedness. Very good. Read another one.
Sometimes I write ephrastic poems, which is a form that you look at a painting and that painting inspires you. So I don't know if you're familiar with the work by Richard Diebenkorn.
I know his paintings.
Yes. So this is his a poem off of his painting, Man and Woman Seated, 1958. Man and Woman Seated, 1958. They're negotiating. He says he is sorry and she does not believe him. It is her studio. He does not belong there. Her aubergine paint will harden unattended. The light, her light, is prime, and it is time before fog and swells. She has stopped listening. Paper, his paper, flutters in front of her lap. And when he leans, tries to reach, she stares at him, over him, through him, to the dunes, the sea beyond, and thinks the wall is too gray, and moves left to give herself more room, enough room to get up, slightly turn, signal. It is time for him to go.
Great idea it is to use other works of art to stimulate poetry, yes.
Yes.
Yes, other poets recently that we have interviewed also presented the ekphrastic kind of work. It's always interesting as a teacher, of course, to do that. If you find that works well to have students become more fluent, it's a good practice to actually continue for weeks or a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I remember using Van Gogh's Starry Night.
Oh.
What an effect that had on students. And one especially had some severe, she was severely challenged with dystrophy. And so speaking was not very easy. But she went away and tapped out some verses on the Starry Night. The first line was, Van Gogh see the universe rough.
Oh, my.
And I said, wow. That's a way to start a poem, you know?
Yes.
So she came back a little bit later and had continued. It was priceless.
Yeah.
Priceless.
Yeah.
Sometimes it works well like that. As you have done a job to recreate the imagery of Diebenkorn. Yeah.
I love Diebenkorn's work. I also have looked at, when I have taught creative writing and a frostic poem, I've used Bruegel's The Fall of Icarus, which has so many wonderful, wonderful pieces and imageries in it. And the farmer just going on and doing its thing. And then the ships are out at sea. And yet there's all this chaos in this seam of normalcy. you know?
Yes.
It's
That's right. The subtle image in the background of the boy splashing.
Yes. Down. Yeah. Yeah. It almost.
Yeah, well.
In speaking of, you know, thinking about the times, it almost can be where we are now, right? You know, just there's this seeming
very much so.
Normalcy, but it's really different. Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of high flyers are taking a dive.
Yes, that's right.
Seeing Icarus at work, and I hope it doesn't happen to too many young people.
No.
I hope it's the Daedaluses that do most of their passing away.
Yes, yes. You know, I've got another ekphrastic one. I wasn't planning on reading it. Let me get it. Several years ago, there was an exchange between a group of Chinese artists and Western Washington artists and Chinese poets and Western Washington poets that was set up by some professors at PLU and also the Ryan James Gallery in Kirkland and some other entities in Kirkland. And it was called Finding Art, Poetry and Art. And the image, I know radio won't be able to see it, but I'll hold it up for you. This was the image that I wrote to. And the Chinese artist was Yang Li, and he entitled the poem Self-Thinking, and I turned it into a piece, which then I was honored that they used my poem with the image as the invitation for the whole ceremonies and the festivities. So this is called Cerulean. Because water spins clockwise, because our routines are predictable, because paint is still wet, I let you pretend I am purple, let you shape me like a spoon, not a cup, draw me into this vortex of an unfinished journey. Still air, eye of hurricane, it is politicianing, throwing lightning bolts, disturbing the lily pads. Or is madness this tropical cyclone? You, a red spoon, beckon me to fold me, to magnetize me, to ask me how do we dive into cerulean waters, swim as a pod, never to beach ourselves because of uncertainty.
Very surreal, that. Yes, there's a surreal element in that.
There is.
Yes.
There is.
Chagall-like. I could, if I didn't see the picture before, I could have thought of some Chagall images with the coloration blue, his famous blue paintings, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope Josie, that you have enjoyed your time on Sound Poetry. It was a great pleasure to see you again and to have you perform your poems. Thank you so much.
It's wonderful to see you too, and thank you so much again for having me.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
I'm David Gilmore for Sound Poetry, and we've been listening to a former poet laureate of Tacoma, Josie Turner.